does not only reside in his language. Man is his language.
Man is a conversation.
Man is a conversation of God. I mean, this is basic theology. We were created by the Word of God. And that is a word with a capital W, Logos, just as in the first chapters of John and in the first chapters of Genesis. Theologically speaking, man is language. But also sociologically and historically speaking, man is language. Not to get into silly kinds of argumentations that the anthropologists fortunately don't bother with much anymore, but sometimes religious people do who think they understand the Bible. The whole distinction between pre-man and man and the question of the descent or ascent of man through the natural order and so forth has always seemed to be me to be a silly one, because the mark of man is language. When man uses language, and of course there's a very broad definition, we're dealing with man. And apart from it, we're not dealing with man. And, you know, there isn't anything else to be said. There is a whole field of New Testament interpretation, which is hardly new. I suppose some of you have heard of it, called the new hermeneutic, or the new interpretation. It comes out of Switzerland and parts of Germany, which says this, that man is language. Being is language as far as we are concerned. This is the distinction between nature and the realm of the human, you know, without trying to introduce broad splits or anything. And so for people in this particular outlook on theology, Lutherans and Calvinists and so forth, preaching is Christianity. But it isn't limited, and this is a thing that we need to resist. You see, in the kind of argument we carried on the last couple of days around here in a good-natured spirit, it isn't limited to behind lecterns and pulpits or even sitting in chairs around fireplaces. Life is poetry. Life is art. Life is preaching. Life is language.
Life is language.
Life is language. And even the cluttered clay statue, perhaps, that you're talking about down here, a work of art, is language. It's a Babel tower. What did you say? The Tower of Babel, in which language is confused. And to me, that's fun. And to the purist in art, and from the things that we have learned, it's not very artistic. But to me, this is so honest an expression of our time, which is the many tongues, you know, and so forth. And I don't want to hold that up as a beautiful example, but just to defend it. And by the same token, the poetry, which is very difficult to understand, and the plays and the movies and so forth that have no plot line. I immediately think of Bergman's film and some of the French films and also now some American film. One has to involve himself completely in it. There isn't the clear-cut beginning, middle, and end, which is anyone who has been trained in writing or in literature knows are important things. But those things aren't there. You have to put yourself into them, which is what McLuhan means, the difference between a hot medium and a cool medium that invites and brings together. Now, what I want to do right rapidly, if I can, is try to bring some of the various terms that we've been throwing around here this week together, and not in a pretty package, but show you that they are not surds, not without sense. Last night was a part of the whole business on communication, because we were talking about the gifts of the Spirit and the building up of the church. And that is communication in the sense of community, to administer, to preach, to give praise, to pray, to heal. All these things are communicative. And what you had going there, and don't argue with me, please, and don't believe me if you don't believe it, but I just want time to develop the argument a little bit further. Because this may not be true, but it just seems to me the distinction between the clear proclamation, what he says, God's message in that translation, and strange sounds, or the speaking with tongues in the other translation, fits pretty closely this rough typology I threw out the other day between communication and transmission.
The communication or God's message tends more to making it clear so that one understands what's involved to a degree. Whereas the strange sounds or the ecstatic, charismatic, uplifting praise which can come out of that is more the transmission, in other words, direct feeling. It's very much like this, if I can give a poor illustration this early in the morning. We're sitting in a crowded theater, and I'm a very super sensitive person, and I smell smoke before anyone else. Now, I may come over to you and say, "My friend, I have every reason to believe that the theater is on fire. My advice to you is that of the fire chief. Don't panic, but get up neatly from your seat and invite your neighbor very quietly and calmly to accompany you, and let us hold hands and walk silently and calmly out of this theater, lest we trample each other to death." Okay, that's communication. Transmission: I smell smoke. The theater's on fire. And you know, and you bump your neighbor, and you know, well, we may conga line out of that theater, or we may rush out like a herd of buffalo, but what is involved is not the language, but the feeling, you know, it's the distinction. I get an emotion across. And if indeed, you know, the projectionist has smelled the smoke too, he may throw on the lights, suddenly the lights come up, and we, as the poet says about the discoverer at the Pacific Ocean, look at each other with a wild surmise and saying nothing, you know, come close to panic and go flying out of that theater, because transmission of an immediate emotion is there. And it's perfectly possible to do so. It's possible between strangers, and sometimes I think the language of the younger generation about vibrations is a very necessary thing to add to our repertoire of understanding, because I've been in so many strange places and situations in my life that I know it's perfectly possible with people that you have absolutely no basis to understand each other on, with except this common humanity or vibration. But this transmission of immediate feeling is more often the case between people who are close to each other, who know each other. I can look at my wife and tell when she's displeased, you know, even when you can't tell that, and vice versa, and because of long association. Now, you had something.
I don't know, I might have been reducing it, but I was going to say, would not the transmission be a mode of communication?
It is a mode of communication in this, but I want to try to keep it separate for the two reasons, because I want to insist without a harsh spirit on the fact that we must try to understand these things, you know. Not that it's necessary for salvation or eternal happiness to understand these things, but it's more convenient and efficient to understand these things. And particularly since every one of us, I think by our very presence in such a locale, exhibit leadership qualities for the church and the community. In that sense, this is an officer's candidate school. And to you, you know, to others it is a mystery and a secret, but to you we are opening many secrets and mysteries, not that we are smarter than you. Now we can tell you that if you've lost your compass, there is a way that you can find yourself, even through the snow, but very easily through the forest, to come back to your unit. And you can lead and save others. It's in this kind of spirit. So I see the absolute necessity for both of these. In fact, what through the mornings I have been arguing for or presenting to you is the need for that emotive depth, immediate communication, if you want, immediate transmittal element along with communication. What has been the death so many times of our congregations in our Lutheran and the Calvinistic tradition and in the Catholic tradition as well has been our rationalism, like the fundamentalist, that, you know, just straight propositional logic. Do you believe this article of the creed? Once they asked Paul Tillich in my presence, did he believe in Trinity? And I was glad that when he went to Southern California for a semester, they asked him this question, and it was put into a movie that I invested some of my hard-earned money to buy because I revered the man so much I wanted to have this record of his life. And he says, "I don't believe in Trinity. I don't understand Trinity." And here's a man who taught philosophy and theology for 60 years, I suppose. "I don't understand Trinity. How can I believe in Trinity? It's not a question." He says, "Trinity is a matter of faith." It is an article of faith, but I don't believe in Trinity, because you are mixing up now, you know, the cognitive assent to some proposition laid down by someone else who in his pride thinks he understands what Norm and Carol and others have pointed out are really mysteries and ununderstandable, and stealing away, you know, the beautiful part, which is that it is matter of faith. It's given to me. So I don't believe in Trinity, but I have faith in Triune God. We have to be able to make
this. Believes in electricity, though I haven't the most remote idea how a light gets lit. Don't I believe in it?
Actually, I suppose it's the electricity for you would be very much like Trinity. And I think this is a good
example. I believe in it. I mean, I know.
No, I think we're just not trying to use the language precise enough there. You know, I recognize that there is electricity. I don't understand that much about electricity myself. I dare say nuclear physics is like Trinity to most of us. And this is as good a point as any to put in, that science is quite as much an area of faith for most people, and even for practicing scientists, as is religion.
I think if you would have faith by going to the light switch and it goes on.
That's right.
Reason what
you know, I mean,
he said it's a breakdown of the actual word believe.
Rational. Have faith in the reason.
Right. You could believe in electricity if you had some knowledge about resistances and about, you know, kilowattage and about, you know, line distances and this sort of thing and velocities and whatever is involved in the physics of electricity. For most of us, this is not a given. And so we live at the level of faith, I suppose, in these things. What about jet plane? We don't understand all things about jet planes, and yet I don't believe that when I get in jet plane I will go to the East Coast safely. I have faith. This is really true. I have faith in the pilots and the crew and in that machinery. A faith that's sometimes strained by the fact that they, you know, are only human beings with their limitations, and that, you know, we have debased the mechanical arts so much that our equipment doesn't always work very well that we've made. Sometimes I think if it was a Japanese or German plane, the faith would be more justified. But still, we have faith. And the most faithful situation I know to the secular man is hanging there at 37,000 feet, you know, suspended on the air currents.
There's no such thing as cause and effect.
Right.
Any relationship between cause and effect is an inference.
Yeah, right. So we have faith in even the next moment, so to speak.
By using the term belief, don't you mean that you have actual personal knowledge of something?
That's right.
Which
I have actual personal knowledge.
Have.
Right. And none has about the nature of God in that sense except what he has revealed. This would be the point. Stan, did you want to get something in there?
I just didn't hear his...
Yeah, he was talking about Hume's brilliant display that cause and effect, which most of us take to be absolutely factual, you know, is only a matter of the way we look at things. It's an example of the selective process we were talking about in art. There is no such thing as cause and effect, and no logician takes it seriously, nor does any physicist who works beyond, you know, the bare question of surfaces and temperatures. Randomness, chance. We choose post hoc, ergo propter hoc, you know, after the so-called cause, that this is the effect. But it isn't necessarily true. Which is why people beat murder raps and so forth in court, because lawyers are able to point this out even in human relations.
That was the point I was trying to make yesterday afternoon about history.
Yeah. Well, history, of course, is a selective process, yeah. I think the question here is something we're going to have to steer away from because it's pretty big. You obviously know philosophy, but history is what it is and is as objective as it is because it is in the realm of public knowledge. That is, most of us believe that way or we have faith that way. That's the only thing that is objective about history.
As Holman says, poetically being falls on this earth. He would He would create from the commonness of nothingness.
Hildurlin, yeah, the poet you're talking about. Yeah. Yeah.
You say you have no cognitive knowledge of the Trinity. What if a person, when you say when you treat that belief, what do you say?
Well, you see, now this is the question about Christianity and why it isn't the philosophy, a Gnosticism in the Greek sense or the Hindu sense, which, you know, very noble things. We do have knowledge of the person of the incarnate Son. And this is the confession of the Lutheran Church. And it is a Catholic confession that all we know of God is what we know through Jesus Christ, or what God has revealed of himself in material ways, you know, even burning bush. And that, you see, the knowledge that we have then goes through that. So we read Scripture through Christ. But as to knowledge of the persons, we have very little knowledge. Very little knowledge. Isn't a question of knowledge. We aren't saved by knowledge.
Yeah, it's not the issue.
It isn't the issue at all. It's a question of faith. It's a question of trust, really, too.
If where wholeness is being poetically re-involved in this earth, that's establishing his relationship. And I disagree. I feel that the more primary relationship is religiously being involved in this earth.
Now, you would want to make a distinction. He's talking about poetically existing and religiously existing. You want to make a distinction between religiously existing and poetically existing. I would not. I would say to the degree that we do not exercise the talent that we have, and it's certainly true that every living thing has at least one talent in a creative way, whatever that is, to that degree we're not religious. Living religiously means living fully up to the mark. But I don't want us to get off in a philosophical bypass at this point. Let's talk about that in sauna or something. But I think it's a good point, because lots of people, millions of them, many theologians and philosophers will make this kind of distinction and not be able to see maybe some of the things that I heretically say, like I believe that biologists and physicists and so forth are supremely religious men, and even priests many times. I've seen it too many times to doubt it anymore, in their making and in their doing. And I don't, by the fact of reading to you from novels and poetry this week and stressing the literary and humanities side of things, want to imply to you that there's something more religious and spiritual about the word and the film and the play, let me put that on the tape right now, than there is about doing physics and geology and doing chemistry, and particularly doing what is a great love of mine, dissection, and doing the biological and the botanical things of this nature. When I was a student, I used to get lots of dates with pretty girls by doing their dissecting work with them in the laboratory. I would stay there for hours on end because they would get sick, and I was quite good at it, and I still love the study of living things and that nature, and I believe, and like medicine and so forth, which is an applied art rather than a pure one. And this there is poetry, and in this there is religion. If there is not, then religion is worth nothing. It's a totality of things. The reason I stay to the literary and the humanities side is that this is the area in which I've spent my life. And I know, and it would be foolish of me to try to talk to you about physics, because after two or three simple statements, I would be completely barren. So, go and pursue it, yes.
Okay. The I believe is not the issue, but it is still the confession.
No, you're wrong.
You wiped out the first and the third articles for me by saying, well, you cannot say I have cognizance and heart knowledge.
No,
of
but
the
I think.
Or of God the Holy Spirit.
You're carrying, first of all, you're misstating what I said in this sense, and then you're carrying the argument to a ridiculous extreme. Because if we have, you accept that there is the basis for the second person because incarnation, that's what you're reasoning now, right? But you don't have the same kind of basis for first person and third person, is that what you're saying? But I would come back and say that's not true. Because in Scripture we're told, again, everything comes down to Scripture, and it's a matter of faithful hearing, you know. That's a word that isn't often stressed. We've been talking a lot about speaking, preaching, or tonguing, and we haven't been talking about hearing. And in Romans, Paul says, you know, the very creation, very world itself bears witness to the Father, to the Creator. So I think that on the same basis as second person incarnation. And as the third person, the very facticity of his presence among the people of the covenant, that is, the church, and the gifts about which we spoke of some of them last night, is again the same basis as the second. But on these things, this is necessary only for the kind of beings that we are. And it is not in our personal knowledge of them. I think that the Johannine writer said this, correct me if I'm wrong, but it puts it very beautifully, because I believe it is where we all are. It says, Thomas, hast thou believed because thou hast seen me? I tell you, more blessed are they that have never seen me and yet believe. But what he's using, the word believe there, he's using it, it means faith. Pisteo, to have faith. Because you see, every one of us, unless he makes some kind of claim that is periodistic and on its face unchristian, is in the presence of all those who, unlike Thomas, have never seen and yet either believe or disbelieve. All things have been reduced, you know, to faith in that way. We don't have to have the physical visions of presences and so forth about us.
That's the thing that Luther discovered.
Yeah.
His great discovery was discovery of faith over against, I believe.
Just down there, the definition of belief, which was primarily cognitive, and made it a proposition of the heart.
No, but the proposition and heart don't go together. Proposition and heart don't go together.
Well, okay, a...
proposition goes with mind.
A confession from the heart, then.
One uses that as a religious language, and again, it isn't that. It is, if you will, a feeling or a movement. When my heart goes out, when I see someone beautiful or ugly, and you know they're both on the same level and have the same value, there's the ugliness that is holy as well as the beauty of holiness. And I think Dostoevsky makes this very plain. Jesus makes this plain. When my heart goes out, it is not a proposition. You know, she is very beautiful, or he is very, you know, pitiful or something like that. It is a movement of my heart. The great Schleiermacher called it a feeling, and he didn't mean by that just a transitory state of feeling, but a whole movement of being. So it is a different kind of thing. And while it does no harm at all, ordinarily, to confuse the language of mind and the language of heart or spirit, I think when we're doing theology, we have to try to keep them a little clearer. And that's a good place to plug now into poetry, because poetry, the peculiar art of poetry, is that it is an attempt through the use of words, which, you know, cognitively relate things. It is an attempt to evoke images that will move us through feelings to respond or apprehend something, you know, not mentally, but with the total person.
So people won't be confused as we go out here. Since you elaborate a little bit, do you think that the word I believe in the creed, perhaps should be rewritten in Dr. Peter the Historic Gospel?
Yeah.
I think that could confuse some people and deal with your definition.
I would say this. That creed was presented, and the original kinds of creeds were laid down by people whose language was Greek and Latin. And in that, there isn't any question. It's only in German and English that you would, and you know, in other European languages, that this kind of problem could arise. Because what it means for I believe, I have faith. And it's not my faith, of course, but I have received faith that I, you see. And of course, that's not saying it isn't of the mind as well, but the major stress is on the trust.
And the word believe and faith is one and the same thing, more or less, when it comes to religion, but when it comes to electricity, it's separate.
Well, yes, because you see, that's only an analogy, and analogies only make a point or two, and then they break down.
The point was very confusing in that analogy.
Okay, but let's make that, in the case of electricity or natural phenomena, most of us who are not in on the art or the science live at a faith level. We know we use it and trust in it and so forth. But it is perfectly possible for the, by the exercise of our sweat and minds for us to believe in the cognitive sense of knowing something about it. Although finally, even electricity is mystery. But in the question of our relationship to God, we use our minds in so far as we possibly can, and chiefly for the purpose of teaching. I think this is the important thing, of teaching. But really, it never goes very far. It finally is trust. I don't want to put, you know, sort of like the sword into the body of this animal now, but at one point Jesus says, even the devils believe and tremble. Because you see, it's perfectly possible, and John Milton makes very clear that Satan in hell still believes in God, you know, and in his love and his mercy, and the fact that even he could be forgiven, but he disdains it. So belief is not the Christian dimension, if I could put it that way. It is not outside the Christian dimension, but I mean, it is simply not enough for the Christian dimension. It is faith. Follow me. I drop my net and I follow. Yeah.
Would you agree with me if I said, I cannot believe in a future life, but I can have faith in it or hope that you know?
I would agree with you. I don't know if others would, because I would say that's scriptural language. It is all a question of faith.
You see, to believe, there is no, not necessarily any commitment to I believe. But to say I have faith, or
right,
justification by faith, just absolutely implies commitment and action to that faith, and to have trust. One has faith and one has trust, and one is motivated to action. So that's the difficult moment. So it's easy to say, I believe. Well, in a sense.
I believe in order that I may understand.
I believe in order that I may understand. That's exactly right. Tertullian, Augustine, all the great theologians. We have this belief, and there he is using that in the state of faith. It's not apart from the mind, but it's not limited to the mind. And one other simple illustration. How many times haven't we been with other people that perhaps weren't quite as foolhardy or courageous, however you want to look at it, as we were, and they had great doubts or fears, but you had a very distinct feeling that whatever it is that you were engaged in could be carried through. And you'd say, forget that. Trust me. Trust me. Trust me.
I think one of the origin passages in Scripture for myself is Romans 10:9, where it says, if any will confess with his lips, and I'm not sure if they use believe or trust.
It says confess, yeah.
In his heart that Jesus Christ is risen from the dead, he shall be saved.
Right, and this makes the reference to the faith. And of course, you're right in saying that it's both things, you know. I'm not trying to say cut off the head and religions from there down. What I'm trying to say is, for so many of us, it's cut off the head, and religion is this head severed from the rest of the body. So it's the emphasis in the point. But trust me. You don't know how I'm going to get you through this desert without water, but trust me, it can be done. And it's not just my knowledge alone, because it's limited about desert, but I just know I've been in similar situations and have always come through them and will come through this one. I've had that to happen with my own son and lost out in the desert of Mexico, Guerrero State. Yeah. Trust me, and we'll get through. And we got through, you know, and in fact, rather fun, but just trust me. And why do you trust a person? Is it because you know and therefore you can believe that they're capable of anything? Well, if you've lived more than 3 days in the world, you know that no matter how big and how smart a person, they can make mistakes or they're fallible. So that's not an adequate basis for a reasonable person. It's only trust, you know.
You use phraseology, I believe you, Jesus.
Yeah.
Or I trust in you, Jesus.
Yeah.
When I say, or justification by belief.
I think when you say justification by belief, the point becomes very clear, because although many of us have understood that in Lutheran confessionalism, it's definitely what the confessions themselves don't say.
Right.
It's trust in that sense. Because we come to the end, you know, of reason. William James is good from a psychological point of view on this. We come to the end. He says, faith in a fact is often the only way that the fact can be brought into being.
John, we had Jim Burtness was here last summer talking about creeds. And he always spoke of a creed or a confession as being a statement that comes when someone is pushed up against the wall.
Yeah.
And he noted that in all his confessions that they came out of a time when the people, these believers or whatever you want to call them, the Christians or whoever it was, were pushed up against the wall. And they finally had to make some sort of a definitive statement.
Right.
And I think that what you're saying about belief amplifies or comes in on that from another angle. But I think that it ties in very well with that. That it's sort of like a law, too. You know, we have Laverne Rickey comes in. He's the head of the...
Yeah, I know Laverne. Yeah.
And he says, law is God's poverty program.
Yeah.
It's the minimum. And I think that what you're saying here about belief, too, you say we come to an end of reason, but reason is there. Well, when these people were pushed up against the wall, they had to make some sort of a statement, a sort of a rational statement that the people on the outside could hear.
That's right.
And hence the confession. Huh?
This I think is very, very aptly put, because you see, sometimes we get the impression that Christians get around, boy, we know so much about heaven and these things that we're just going to lay them down and nobody can ever make a mistake. But there never was a confession made except in the middle of some kind of religious war. Look at the Book of Concord. And I mean, and the pagan emperor, man not yet baptized, and probably was more just expedient than a real Christian, said to the Christians in the 4th century, you know, you guys go over there and meet, you know, in Western Turkey, and by God, settle this business about the persons and everything, because I'm not going to have you tearing the country up arguing about angels on the heads of pins. That's how we get the Nicene Creed. The Christian way of life is not to go around making creeds, except, as you say, when you absolutely have to make some things clear.
But the early Christian church, when they were... What a confession of faith they made when they went in to entertain the lions.
Yeah. They
walked right into the lions.
Huh? Yeah.
What do you mean, I believe? What's that got to do with walking into the lions? Somehow they were...
Yeah,
some
was...
fantastic trust or something. I don't know what a trust is. But what a confession of faith.
Right.
This is so old that it's hackneyed, but it never loses its power for me. I think it was Polycarp, who was an 80-year-old man or so, and he was taken, you know, in one of the persecutions, and they were going to push him into the lions or to be a target or something like this. And the Roman officer, who was a civilized and a decent man, he said to him, for God's sake, I don't want to do this to you. You're a good man. He says, all you've got to do is salute the flag. You know, all you've got to do is put a little rice or something on the emperor statue. All you've got to do is say, Sieg. Aisle, one time. And that's it. We'll forget about it. Not going to take and push you any further. I don't want to do this to you. And Polycarp says, you know, like 70 years I have served him and he has never betrayed me. I will not betray him. It's not a question of knowledge. It's a question of trust. It's stupid from a rational point of view. Let's make everything clear. It's absolutely dumb.
Jesus in the wilderness. 40 years in the wilderness.
Yeah.
Here's your reason to transcend him.
Yeah, it's a transcendence to the depths of reason.
To get back to the poetry, the poet speaks beyond his words.
Exactly. The best poets speak what they do not know. And that's where the proclamation and the strange sounds come together. And I think in poetry, on a secular level, and humanistic level, as well as spiritual and religious levels, real poets, as opposed to versifiers, of which there's so many, do this, and it comes off. And it always is an act of grace. I mean, it always is if it comes, you know, from beyond you, or it's insight. It's syncretic, or it's a synthesis, a bringing together of things. Pardon?
Metasynthetic.
Yes, if you want to get very technical about it, yeah. It's beyond any rational synthesis of mind, yeah.
No, John, something else, too. You just mentioned transcendence. I missed your example on electricity, but then I heard the recap on it. you stated that finally, even in electricity, you get to the point where it's, as you said, it's a mystery.
Yeah.
And I think that this idea of transcendence is a word which we use in this time between the times, a phrase that Carol used this morning. This time between the times when we do make distinctions between what we say, I know or I believe, in electricity, I flip the switch and it comes on, you know. But there is mystery there. We may forget it in flipping of the switch on and off, but there is mystery there. And maybe transcendence isn't the line between what is fixed and absolutely for sure and what isn't. But maybe transcendence is this thing that's going to come down and take everything up in it. Everything will be mystery. You know, even the things that seem to be very solid and well defined.
Oh, okay.
I have trouble with this idea of transcendence.
Please tell us what you mean by transcendence.
His word.
No, anybody say what they mean by transcendence.
Okay.
There may be some of us that just don't know that.
Well, we have a philosopher with us. Are you going to talk about transcendence?
No.
What does it mean?
Yes.
Talk louder, okay, and tell me.
Okay. I think that it could not be said any better than this. This is 1 Corinthians 22. For Jews demand the sign, and Greeks seek after wisdom. So the transcendence is your that you believe in the sign. And our Greek education was the reason.
To transcend, it's a movement of spirit. And here, since what this little side thing that's been going between this young man and myself, you must give is the peculiar bit of philosophy. He used the word metta, M-E-T-A, and you have to put that in there. It's that peculiar movement of spirit which is possible, as far as we know, only in man, and what most of us think of as image of God, in which we are able to go beyond ourselves, and we are able to look at the whole of things, of life, of our situation, including ourselves. Do you not know that we will judge angels, Paul says in one place, but of course primarily we are able to judge ourselves. This, it is the turning back, if you will, of our inward life upon itself, such that the whole business is available to us for our inspection. And for our confession of our sinfulness, we're able to rise above ourselves. We are not trapped, in lava so that we can't move spiritually, but we can move.
So then the transcendence is really a gift from God.
It is, and it's a gift from...
The ability to get outside ourselves is obviously nothing that we could do, right?
No, but it's there because that's the way God made us, you see. This is the important thing. All men have the potentiality of transcendence, but only those who are touched by faith fully exercise it, I would say. And there's a transcending on the secular level, which is seen in the great poets, it's seen in the great thinkers.
Yeah.
There's secular transcendence as well as religious transcendence.
The philosopher out of his being, and the poet out of his God and holy.
Very often, this is the case, yes. And at the higher levels, perhaps, or at one level, if you're philosophical and theological, you say God is being itself, as a man says. And nothingness, too, when you understand that, too. But that is somewhat sophisticated, I think. Well, poetry. I don't know what to say. Last night I tried to share one poem with you, and Freudian slips are really interesting. This little sheaf of poems is, except for the last two pages, identical to the ones I chose from one of my books 4 years ago when I was here for use in poetry small groups. I hope that we'll get some of those going here that aren't part of the official schedule, but just because we want to be together. But two poems appended to it that are fairly new, and that's the only difference. But it's interesting that when it was typed up here before, and since I use things over and over again, I constantly have to speak and be places, as most of us do. I beg your pardon, sir. And it's been typed up and stencils cut and, yeah, in a number of states and provinces and so forth. And every time, even though I have used a pencil on the copy I gave to the, this is really true, it's kind of interesting to me anyhow. Go ahead and take that. Every time I have taken the master, so to speak, and gone through and corrected, because errors creep in. It's part of the beauty of life that errors do creep in, I guess. And I've rubbed out the fact. Transparency, the poem on the spirit, always gets typed twice. Did you notice? And I'm not saying it's a great poem, because it's not, but it always gets typed twice, and I don't know why. That's true. I tell you that my wife cut the original little stencil of selected poems like this. I have a book of poetry. Someone said, did you ever publish it? And I can say I tried about a million times and finally gave up, because people don't publish poetry. Finally, I just published them seriatim here and there, one at a time, and I guess about everything I've written in the poetic line has been published one place or the other, but not in a book. But transparency keeps coming back twice. I wonder what that's trying to say. I read it last night. I'll read it again. But I'd like to read it in juxtaposition, but from, what is it, the second page now, where it appears on the right-hand side. On the left-hand side is a poem that needs to be read first. And again, maybe for this young man, this will make sense, the title, to the rest of you, not maybe, maybe it does, it's unnecessary that it does. I dedicated this to Heidegger, one of the German philosophers, who writes about totus eendus, that is, that we, in life, we find ourselves moving towards death. And that's certainly true. Man is the being whose being is towards death, and we need to remember that. I'm not now trying to introduce a morbid note on a beautiful morning, because death to me is not morbid. The manner of death often is, but death itself is not, and I don't see how it can be for the Christian, or even the generally religious man, a morbid thing. But this is not a Christian poem. It dates back in my development as whatever I am, and I don't know what I am. It's only a couple of paragraphs out of a longer poem about death. I wrote after getting out of a military hospital where I was laid up for a year with wounds. I sometimes wake up in the night and lie there in the dark and think and wonder if I gained a loss by living it, and feel cold needles prick my back when I think that someday a day like this will be my last on earth. I wonder if other men are prone to wake and wonder as I am, and if they feel a thrill of fear at the thought of a world that will go on as if we never lived, when they and I are nothing but the floating dust that catches and reflects the bright rays of the sun. Now, that's a good, honest poem, even though it isn't a good poem. It was very honest when it was written, anyhow. It's pagan, or it's generally human, and I would defy anyone, no matter how advanced in the Christian way that he may or she may believe themselves to be, to say that they have completely lost that element. Because to the degree that they had, they are but a hollow shell and no true person, living being. It is still there in us. We are sanctified sinners. You know, we are redeemed creatures. We're still sinners and we're still creatures, and so part of this is in it. Over against this now from a later time, not when I was a better person or anything, but in different context and under the impression of Christianity, and actually it happened here at Holden Village, this little poem, Transparency, came about. Not in the dark. And think about the long night watches of the dark.
It's a beautiful thing at Holden, I think, that we do get the chance to go and sleep outside or to sit up for late hours out on the porch there and look at the stars. It's something you can hardly see from our urban areas. Look at the dark, the very deep black darkness, sometimes when there is no star, and to feel the immensity of this universe and, you know, what life is really all about. It's not yet, thank God, completely paved and street lighted. Not in the dark, even then, nor in the deep, not in the vision, nor in sleep, not with external show of power, but there within the average hour, there in the nexus, intertwined, person to person together, there in a moment, within time, there within reason, in its due season, happens a miracle, the new being, which will kill the old man within us. Thus does the spirit feed, man's spirit, at this spelling, its point of need, healing an estranged race by the pharmacology of grace. And what I'm trying to say is I don't want to stand up and make confession. I once was a pagan, and I thought of death as nothingness, and now I don't do that anymore. I've been raptured out of the world into some spiritual heaven. What I'm trying to say is here in the nexus of the community of the people that God has called together at Holden or Acapulco and Helsinki or Berlin, in time, in space, here, the Holy Spirit is present. Here, you know, we can be brought into the trust relationship, which is healing, which allays the anxieties, which we never lose. They come back. Now, just before you climb every mountain, I'm sure you must feel, you know, how hard it's going to be. And you have to work up the moxie to do that. When you stand in the door of an airplane to jump out with a parachute, every time, the ones that live long, you know, you have to work up the guts to take the first step. You know, when it becomes play, or when it becomes thoughtless, well, that's when you strangle yourself or something. You have to work up the guts every time. But the guts, the courage, the strength, is there. And this, I think, is what is meant, and I won't go into the long homily about giving us each day our daily bread.
Would you can just go and I have something I'd like to read?
Yeah, get it. Right. Very good. So, this one is too philosophical to be poetry, because poetry can't be overly philosophical, or it loses, you know, the concretion of image that can evoke this transmittal or this strange sound, this ecstasy, which is other than normal cognitive use of words. And so this one dilates that. I'll tell you that now, although you know it, but it's the one on water. And this was written down by Railroad Creek at the old sauna, the river sauna. Symbol. More than symbol. Ontologically rooted in its properties. Ontology means basic being. Ontically exemplified. Ontic means on the existence level. Renewing phenomena that is happening. Not appearance. Actually achieving the promised washing. Regeneration, recreation, cleanliness, new openness for living, aqua Christus, water of Christ. Now, I would fight with other theologians and say that that's good theology. It's not good poetry because it takes too much interpretation. It uses philosophical words, but I didn't know how to put it any better at the time.
I think at that point it doesn't make any difference, John.
I hope that's true, but
it's not. Because the word itself is a mystery. Yeah. I mean, to those of us who might not know the word, we still have a sense of mystery. I think that in culminating in Aqua Christus, that it's mystery. Yeah. And so consequently, the use of what we might say a strange word adds to the mysteriousness of it and the miracle of it. And to me.
I'm glad of that.
John, may I ask you a question?
Yeah.
What season here is poem here? I think your poems are very important.
Well, that's a poet talking.
Yeah, but I mean, what would you consider in here? It's something that speaks to us and we can more readily understand.
When it speaks to you on all the levels, when it is, you know, not just an intellectual experience, and not just an emotional experience. For example, there are poets, the didactic poets, they're called, you know, from several centuries back, where they speak on an intellectual level, particularly making all the references to Ilium and Troy and so forth. And we know about those kinds of things. And then there's the sentimental mush that doesn't have to be as bad as Eddie Guest or some of the religious poets, but the sentimental thing, and it speaks just to the heart. You just want to cry right away, but you don't know why, really. You don't feel any better after you've cried. Sort of like Greta Garbo, Flick, or something like that. You might cry a little bit, you know, but when it's over with, nothing has really been accomplished because no change has taken place. Now, here's one that ought to make you angry. Most people do.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Have you gone on since the Heidegger in Transparent?
I haven't gone on. I did read them, yes. Now, you have something you want to read on that?
Yeah, that I think that may connect them somehow.
Beautiful. Go ahead. Read loud, okay?
Read loud. Please.
And perhaps you could explain the connection better than I.
Well, go ahead and read loud. Fine. I don't know if I can about that.
The name of this is Time. Old woman stands, alive with death. Breathes deep, looks deep, sees all. The old woman stands tall. On her majestic mountain she stands, observing the past, realizing the present, pulsating the future. The old woman knows. What does she leave behind? Face of fire, eyes of ice. Smile of love. The old woman still stands.
Human endurance. That's a very good poem. Is that yours? That's good.
Mm-hmm. But I see there's a connection.
Yeah, I do too. I see the connection in the empowering of the old woman's spirit, you know, in the face
smile.
And in the smile, the acceptance. Yeah. Very definitely. By the way, I thought the poem from Black Elk this morning was a supremely Christian statement myself, to see the world in its totality and to see our hoop as part of all the hoops. It's straight out of Elijah.
Yeah, really?
Yeah, straight out of Elijah, similar kind of experience. It is, someone asked me about transcendental meditation or transcendental states the other day. That is a transcendent state, and it happens to men. And I can tell you, you don't have to take chemicals to have it. So it is a vision of God. I read you a couple more, and then I'm violating your coffee hour, so if you want to leave, you can. I am deeply impressed by the world and by my responsibility for it. And I am deeply opposed to religion that flies from the world. And to me, spirituality is not Christian in the sense that we usually use it. And that's why the kind of things you hear me saying, I'm more convinced that it's not a question of saving oneself by works or anything, but that God is praised by putting your hands to the plow, or by even to the gun if it is necessary, putting your hands to the always imperfect but always demanded act of service in the world that we have. I'm not worried about the life to come. This
this life, one at a time, one day at a time, but not just in the sense of living like the bird, who even, he the bird makes some provision for his tomorrow. I won't be anxious about tomorrow, but I will plan for tomorrow. I think it's the better part, because in the last analysis, it is man's mind and his cunning even, rather than his strength or his great resources, that makes a difference between whether the good or the evil is victorious. And again, I think it is necessary that the good be victorious. It is too easy to always fail and say it doesn't matter, it's in God's hands. We blame a lot on God that is due to nothing but a lack of guts and a lack of love. And God lacks neither courage nor love, and I think he would not have us lack either. This is a poem that occurs as a section in one of my books. It's not really a poem. It's about revolutionaries. Because the Christians were first called revolutionaries. And the sadness is that they have been called revolutionaries so few times since. Behold, they turned the world upside down, is the first name given to this way. In griefs because of wounds he feels, because no gap can separate the mystic solidarity of the human race, the radical's organic unity expresses self in loss of self through revolution. Third page from the back. Reformation being but a name, a bon mot for revolution. Reformation but revolt under the impact of an inward and spiritual aim. Crying, on your corpses if we must. We will build a world where they're being worked for all without exception, without rank, there will be no slaves. Where war is being given, nobody goes. Every man in every country seeing the foolishness of poor killing poor, saying, I will not fight, save only to conquer ignorance and disease, prejudice and pain. In nonviolence where possible, with hell's power where necessary, there will be no wars. When every man says, I will be free, have enough to eat, a good place to live, books and music for my mind and spirit, a right to worship or not as I see fit, there will be true freedom. Where every man and woman says, we will bear only those children we desire, there will be families. Where every person says, I will not, to every power is an authority that authenticates the present system, telling in filthy words what can be done with wars and welfare, profits and prophecy, promises and propaganda, where each one declares, standing forward, letting the policeman note each name and address, I will not live in ignorance or die in fear, nor suffer needless pain and deprivation in the interim between birth and death. Then there will be true men on the earth, men who might give credence to the folk tales that speak of spirit, men who might spit in the divinity's eye, who might be worthy of the fabrication of a god in their image, or bear a god's image themselves. It's a little rough. It's based on a real experience, which a poem must be, like stepping forward so the policeman can clearly spell your name. I've seen it a dozen times, and it's not an easy thing to do. But when they said, which one is Jesus, he's the one that I will give the kiss, he didn't deny that he was Jesus. And then the final one, I was surprised I won the state poetry contest with this one. I sent it off because I saw it advertised in the magazine. It is not very good. You heard it the other day. This and we quit. I was born, by the way, where this poem was made, and is a beautiful place, full of horror, as all beautiful places are. mud gray and porous, beaten with smooth worn edges, the walls of the tenant cabins, soaked with the tears of untreated sickness, dried in the sweat of exploitation, made cold by the darkness of forgottenness. Huddled in groups under dying oaks, peopled with spirits and off-breed chickens, invaded by invalided motor cars now rusting, companioned by old cans and tires, black, deep black, shiny black, gleaming with humanity though marked by other men's inhumaneness, the faces greet us, quiet, musky, still, far from the highway, not yet to the sea, lost between the rivers of concrete and the rivers of salt, there in the tall grasses, under the Spanish moss, finite suffering and infinite patience, swear by the love of Christ that you will work and fight for the poor and ignored. By their fruits you shall know them. I enjoyed this week.
Thank you.